Last week, Rabbi Rich shared a moving message with us with some lessons from Jacob and Esau on living well, how to live well. And I want to pick up again on that theme and just sort of expand and go in an additional direction here. And this week, focus on living a life of vision, purpose, and calling. Living a life of vision, purpose, and calling. And so we'll start by looking at Jacob and Esau through our parsha this morning and also a few weeks ago and our readings this week. And then to conclude, similar to Rabbi Rich, actually, I want to share with you about a close mentor of mine who recently died from cancer and talk with you about some lessons that I've learned from him. So vision, purpose, and calling. So now, how many of you have heard of the pop Christian book, The Purpose-Driven Life? Of course. How many of you have read it? Yeah. Anyway, the title says it all, right? It's a great title, and that's why the book sells. It's because of the title, Purpose-Driven Life. I think that Jacob, Yaakov, had a purpose-driven life. And although Jacob didn't seem to be any more virtuous than Esau, and, you know, he didn't go about his purpose in the most upright of ways, like we read about last week. You know, he lived a life out of God's larger promise. Esau, however, he didn't seem to know who he was or have a sense of his purpose. You know, he followed his own passions. He went to hunt for game. He married the wrong women. He was hungry, so he, you know, gave away his inheritance for a bowl of soup. Then he lost his father's blessing and then lost his brother because he drove him away out of a spirit of revenge. Now, I think that a lot of people go through life with like a vague sense of something they want to achieve and someone they want to become, but like Esau, have very little vision or awareness of who they are or what they're called to do. So often people make their major life choices based on desires and fears, or sometimes even other people's desires and other people's fears, rather than living based on God's vision, his purpose, and his calling on their lives. Now, the result is that we can accidentally trade our own inheritance in the kingdom for the equivalent of a lifetime supply of lentil soup. Now, I like the analogy that Stephen Covey uses in his famous book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. He talks about this. If you want to get in a jet and fly from the U.S. to Israel, but you neglect to take the time to figure out on the map where Israel is on the map, and instead you just launch into the sky hoping that you'll get there, the chances of finding Israel are like a needle in a haystack, right? But if you know exactly where Israel is and you keep your target in sight, then likely you'll land. But the way that a jet flies is sort of like the way a canoe paddles. So it goes a little this way, and then it corrects and goes a little this way, and then it goes a little this way, and then corrects and goes back. So in a sense, even though the jet is actually off target most of the time, you'll still land where you want to because you're keeping your goal, Israel, in mind, your vision, your purpose, and your calling. So that's what happened with Jacob's life. To play on the analogy a little bit, he kept Israel in his sights. And he went a little bit to the right in deceit and failure, a little bit to the left with challenges along the way. But God's call in his life was so strong that God's purposes were still played out. And Jacob landed in Israel, or we might even say became Israel. Now, we might wonder, who would actually get in an airplane and take off across the ocean without a destination? But we do this with our lives all the time, don't we? Like, we launch into living without GPS coordinates. And then we wonder why we later crash landed somewhere in the Atlantic. Now, there are a lot of motivational books out there that use phrases like, keep the end in mind. And these are good resources, but I want to suggest that these books leave out the most important step in seeking after God's calling for your life. They leave out God's calling. So, growing up, I knew that I wanted to experience purpose and meaning in my life. I always had that sense. I knew that I had some experience, something, some place I wanted to land, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. I didn't know which runway to take off of, see? So I lived life, and in my experience, I felt a passion for music and a desire to become great, and I thought that happiness lay in the conquest of my own pursuits. So in high school, I would actually get up early in the morning and skip all my classes, and I'd practice the trumpet for 5 or 6 hours a day, you know, so that I could get into the New England Conservatory to practice my freshman year 10 hours a day in the practice room, literally, because I was driven towards success. See, I wanted that job with the six-figure salary, with the prestige, with the respect, one of the top orchestras in the world. And then somewhere in my fourth year of college, I crash-landed because I was driven, but I wasn't called. You see the difference? I was driven, but I wasn't called. Now, imagine that you want to fly to Antarctica, but God is calling you to fly to Israel, but you don't listen. So you plug in Antarctica. Now, you might get there, but it won't be what you thought it was going to like. Your successes won't bring you the kind of happiness that you were looking for. So for me, flying to Antarctica wasn't what it was made out to be. So I decided to walk. And then finally, God had to rescue me while I was wandering through the White Mountains, walking from Maine to Georgia. Those of you who know my story, I won't go into it any more than that. Anyway, Raina and I like to pray for each other. And one of the things we've learned how to do in our prayer team here is to pray for healing of past memories and trauma and things in our past that seem to still speak into our lives today in a negative way. And so we were praying together one evening through a memory that I had in high school, just after I'd found out that I didn't make the senior district band. And that was like traumatizing for me because my friend did. And I remember in the memory, I was standing in the woods outside the school, and I was crying, and I was angry, and I was really hurt. And as we prayed through this memory, I saw myself there in the forest, and the whole forest looked like it was filled with prisms of light. That was the sense I had. And it seemed as if a figure of light, like a cold blue light, was approaching me. And I knew intuitively in this sort of vision, if you will, that it was Yeshua. And I heard him come up to me, and it was as if he said to me, "This isn't what I called you to do." And now I expected, have experience with these sorts of things, and I expected that he was going to be like, "I'm with you, you know, it's okay, you'll get it next time, you know, keep at it, buddy." But I heard, "This isn't what I've called you to do." And that was healing, because even though I'd already felt that God had given me a strong call and a strong purpose and calling on my life, it was a reminder that it isn't about me. It isn't about my success. It isn't about my failures. It's about God and what he would do with my life. So going back to Jacob, he's running away from his brother. We can imagine that he's feeling totally bummed out that his mother got him into this big mess. And maybe he's feeling like the blessing that he received wasn't even legitimate because it was stolen. And maybe Jacob feels like a failure. But then he has a vision with angels going up and down on a stairway or ladder into heaven. And I think of it like God saying, "No, Jacob, I've got plans for you. You have a great calling on your life. It isn't about you and it isn't about your brother. It's about me and the work that I'm doing through you." Living out your calling will give you what you need to get through hard times. So if you're stuck in hard times and you feel like there's nowhere to go, it's vision, it's purpose, it's calling that will get you out. It gives you hope. In our parsha this week, Jacob panics when he finds out that Esau is coming to meet him with 400 men. And Jacob assumes that Esau is going to slaughter him and his whole family. Rightfully so. I mean, I'd probably think the same thing. But he prays to God something like, "Listen, you told me to go back home. You told me you'd make my offspring a great nation. If you kill me now, your purposes won't come to pass." See, Jacob was still scared, but he could remind himself that he was following God's calling. He was part of something bigger than his own experiences. And we need that too in our lives, because we're part of something bigger than ourselves, if we'd only look up and see it. And this is why this is so important, that you seek God in everything that you do, in every decision that you make. Decisions like, where does he want me to go to school rather than where do I want to go to school? Who does he want me to marry? Where does he want you to work? And some of you, maybe asking or have asked whether he wants you to work outside the family or to take on the challenging call of being full-time at home, raising and educating children. Again, not about you, about him. Do we seek God even for how many kids he might want us to have? Where should you live? How does he want you to invest your time? What is the purpose that you've been given in life? Who does he want you to be? And I want to encourage you not just to think about this, but set aside some time to actually come up with what you feel like God is calling you. Put it down on paper, you know, like your vision statement, if you will. You know, what is God's vision for your life, and how are you going to live out that call? Let's not go with the default. Let's really seek God in our lives, because, again, it's not about you. It's about God and how he's going to use you. Now, once you have a good sense for vision and values and calling, then you have to live it, and that's the hard part, right? It's easy to put something on paper, but how do you live it? And that's where we need to be wise about investing our time and making sure that we, for the famous phrase, put first things first, right? So let's look at our Besora passage now, Luke 4:16-21. Yeshua is in his hometown. He attends the local synagogue during the Torah service, and he reads out from the scroll of Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, to proclaim freedom for the captives, recovery for sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And then again, he sits down, just like we read, and he says, "Today the scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." Now, Celia said this perfectly. This is like Yeshua's mission statement. It's his vision. And he speaks it over the people. And then what does he do right after this? After he almost gets pushed off the cliff and then walks away, he goes and he does all these things. He heals people. He touches people. He frees them. Matthew 11:5, "The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cured, the deaf are heard, the dead are raised, the good news is preached to the poor." He went and did it. Now, ask yourself this question. If you only had 3 years to change the human race before you were going to be martyred for the sake of all humanity, how would you spend your time? Go to Chicago, is that what you said? Now, wouldn't it have made sense for Yeshua to just say, "Okay, look, we don't have all that much time. There's a lot of people we got to get to. You gather over here. I'm going to meet you at 1 o'clock tomorrow, and we're going to heal everybody." Right? But he didn't do that. He spent days and days healing and touching individuals. It says that all day he spent healing people. Insignificant, regular people, one by one. Because Yeshua's call was to begin to transform our broken world one heart at a time. And I might suggest that this is a good place for us to begin as we pray and work out our own sense of vision and calling in our lives. We need to understand that our time is a gift from God, and it's the greatest resource that you have to actualize God's call in your life. The greatest resource. Now, I'm sure you've heard this analogy, so forgive me, but you have a jar. You have rocks, and you have sand that will fit into the jar. If you put the sand in first, the rocks don't fit. But if you put the rocks in first, the sand will come in and fill in the cracks of the jar. So I think that if you haven't spent significant time parsing what in your life is a rock, the big important things, and what in your life is the sand, the less important things, then most likely your jar will fill up with sand and not with rocks. So in other words, if you spend your precious time that you've been given on the wrong priorities, you'll wake up one day wondering why the most important things in your life seem to be falling apart. Like Esau, the tendency is to focus on the urgent, what is present. But like Jacob seemed to understand, what is right in front of him wasn't necessarily more important. Now, a few years ago, I was privileged to spend a year being mentored in time management by the president of the EMC Corporation here in Massachusetts. He was a high-powered businessman who worked a 70-hour day in charge of 4,600 employees But he was also a father of four and seeking to be a faithful Christian husband and man. So put all those things together. When I first met him, I was like, I need to learn from him and how he does this. And he wrote a book called about time management called The Juggling Act, which was about balancing being home and present while also being highly effective in the workplace. And so we would meet out at the plant in Hudson at 6:45 a.m., where he would spend 45 minutes to the dot combing through my vision statement and goals and then help me to effectively use my time better for the sake of God's kingdom and the work that he's doing in my life. And, you know, for those of you who have ever said, I'm too busy for my wife or my kids, you know what? There really are enough hours in the day to be effective with a busy schedule while investing significant quality time one-on-one with the most important people in your life. There really is enough time. But you'll have to work hard to cut out all the extras. And I mean all the extras, if you really want to live it well. You just need to make sure you spend your time, how you spend your time reflects first your priorities, and then that your priorities reflect your vision and values about life, and that your vision and values reflect God's call on your life. Ecclesiastes teaches us to number our days. And so many people on their deathbed look back and wonder where the time went and why their lives are such a mess. You don't want to look back and regretfully say, I wish I'd spent more time serving God. No one says that. I mean, they say that, but they don't say, I wish I spent too much time serving God, is what I meant to say. Right? They don't say, I spent too much time serving God, you know? Or I wish I'd spent more time building meaningful relationships with the people that God has put into my life. Now, my last point here is probably the most important part of living a life of vision, purpose, and calling, and that is that we need a healthy dose of chesed, a healthy dose of mercy, a healthy dose of kindness and grace in our lives. Now, we wonder why God still seemed to honor Jacob even though he attained the blessing and inheritance through deceiving his brother. I don't think that God really approved. I don't think that's the point. But that even though they were a broken family and that maybe they didn't go about it the wrong way, God still met Jacob that night as he slept with his head on the rock and reaffirmed Jacob's call, I'm still with you. And Jacob wrestles with the mysterious divine figure that we read about today. And our sages suggest that this was an opportunity for Jacob to change from the patterns of running away and deceit to trusting God and facing his brother. And in this scene, we're reminded of Jacob stealing his father's blessing when Jacob asks the divine figure to bless him. And he says, "What is your name?" It gives Jacob an opportunity to tell the truth this time. And then he can be restored. Esau lived a life of all the wrong priorities. But in the end, his saving grace was just that, grace. He was able to forgive his brother, and they were able to reconcile, at least on some level. Now, I take comfort in this. You know, we're all broken human beings. We all mess up. We all fail. But God can still use us in our brokenness. And not only that, he can use our brokenness for good if we trust him. Because God is merciful and he's gracious, he can put all the pieces back together. And at least while we're alive in this world, it's never too late. Don't ever say it's too late. It's not. Now, we've been talking in theory here about living a life of calling, and I want to change the gear slightly and share with you someone who I think really lived this out in his own time that he walked here on earth. And he lived well, put it that way. I met David Midwood 6 years ago at a meeting for Christian denominational leaders in New England. And I was there to represent our synagogue here as we, you know, one of the things we do is seek to share awareness of Messianic Judaism and the Jewish people to the Christian world. And he was the president of the organization that was running the meeting, so I asked him to do lunch with me. Now, we met at the Burlington Mall for a lunch and a leisurely stroll. That was his thing. And I was just about to have my first son, Chaim, and so I asked him to share with me his most important parenting advice. If he had to share one thing, I said, what would your most important parenting advice be? And without pause, he said, love your wife. And I would say that largely because of that shaping comment, Raina and I have adopted a core value in our own mission statement that in our home, for our children's sake, we must prioritize our marriage above the kids' needs. That allows the kids to get caught up in our marriage, providing a sense of family security and belonging and safety. So thank you, David. Now, in a very gentle way, David began to speak into my life, and what was initially just a networking meeting turned into a life-shaping mentoring relationship. And we met just about every month for 6 years until David was diagnosed with late-stage cancers. And then within 6 weeks, he rested in Yeshua's arms from day one to the end. Now, this is a little moving for me. Excuse me. David was someone who loved life. And the thing with David was that he longed to be in his Abba's presence even more than he loved life. And every time we'd meet, that was part of the conversation. David shared something with me that was intangible. David, this just happened like a month ago. So anyways, forgive me. Okay, David shared with me I'll start this way. Imagine this, he's a 6 foot tall, big guy. Really big. I'm not that tall. 5'9", he's big. He was confident in his masculinity and who he was as a man in a very strong way. You could kind of feel it. And every time I'd get to our meeting at the end, he'd give me a big bear hug and he'd look at me in the eye and say, "I love you." Now, coming from a reserved New England culture, I didn't like that. I was uncomfortable. It challenged me. Every time I'd feel uncomfortable, and that's one of the reasons why I kept going back to meet him. I wanted to face that. But over time, I began to see that David was instilling in me a sense of secure masculinity. And I never asked him about this, but I think that David was intentionally trying to model and impart God's fatherly love to me, because he was someone who believed in me, not just because of what I did, but because of me. Now, for one reason or another, I was usually late to our meetings because I didn't practice a lot of the stuff I was learning, and so I was running around like crazy busy. One time, I got turned around in the freeway, stuff started to happen, and I was an hour and a half late for our meeting. But there David was, big smile, big bear hug, relaxed, loving presence, he literally said, "I love you even if you're late." And then he would carve out 3 hours, a busy guy, 3 hours to take me out to a fancy lunch, you know, and we would just sit and talk. We'd have coffee, everything. We'd pray together. And David would always give me a straight answer and hold me accountable to everything. He loved to say, "So tell me the sins in your life." One time he said to me, out of the blue, "Do you think God likes your busyness? You think God likes your busyness?" He was fond of saying, "Okay, so you blew it, but God still loves you, and I still love you." He helped me prioritize my time. So he would call me out when I would work an 80-hour work week, you know? And he would say, you know, "Look, are you coming home on time? Are you prioritizing the most important things in your life?" And while I was working on detailed time management over here with Pat, the other mentor I mentioned, David would slow things down and help me not to get too caught up in the schedules that I could never keep. And he taught me how to throw the entire schedule out for a person. I remember one time I came to meet him at his New Hampshire office, and the office was empty, but I heard David singing in his booming voice in the bathroom to the Lord. He loved to sing hymns in the bathroom. And to be honest, I'll always remember that. That was shaping for me, and I find myself here in the building. You know, I have to ask for forgiveness for everyone else, but singing in the bathroom to the Lord, you know, because he taught me to rejoice in him and to not worry or care about what others thought and to not worry or care about how busy I was. But even more, David helped me to experience God rejoicing over me. David was a major player in encouraging me to pursue trainings in healing prayer with the McNutts. Not for my sake, but he was very enthusiastic about our congregation and our movement picking up the mantle of Yeshua's healing in the Jewish narrative in the Jewish world. David was the first one to coach me in praying in the spirit, with the prayer language, praying in tongues, and to reconnect to the simple truth of his love. And we would do that together, transforming. And I can really say that David's investment in me made me a better follower of Yeshua, a better husband, a better dad, a better rabbi, and a better man. And the thing was that somehow, though he was a successful lead pastor at like 5 different churches, a denomination leader, a father himself, probably busier than most of us, David seemed to make this time to mentor dozens of other men just like me. And I started to speak more at different places around New England and whatnot over the past 5 years or so. I would regularly meet people who would say that David was their mentor for the past 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. And we had this bond, you know, like David mentored us. It was this bond that we had. David always told me that relationships come first. Invest in people. Transform lives. And you know what? There were at least 1,000 people at his memorial service. And it seemed as if everyone felt the same way about David that I did. Touched, encouraged, and most of all, loved. Now, David left a legacy on earth because he invested in people one heart at a time. And David died when he was only 65 years old. So let's learn from his life. Let's learn from Jacob and Esau. Let's learn from Yeshua. Let's learn before it's too late. And I'll close with a quote from Pirkei Avot, "If not now, then when?" Shabbat Shalom. Thank you, everyone.